My name is Steph Zemba, and I'm here with Price on March 18th, 2021, as part of the Southwest Virginia LGBTQ History Project Oral History Initiative. We're doing this interview over Zencastr. So, hi, Price, and welcome.
Hi, Steph.
Could we just start off, with your childhood, trying to, just give us like a little bit of an overview of that?
Of my childhood?
Like where you grew up and what childhood was like for you.
Yeah, so I grew up in a really small town in North Alabama, probably about 500 people, maybe 600 people, one stoplight, two churches. My parents were, my mother was from there. My dad was, from New York. So we were a little bit of an odd, family there because my dad was a Yankee and, he drank beer and, the local church wasn't too happy with that. He was also atheist. On one side, it was the church. We went to church every time the doors were open. We went to the Southern Baptist Church with my grandparents. And then the other side, was my dad, who was an atheist. So it was kind of a, it was nice because I had a little bit of a buffer from the hell and brimstone that was, taught at the church. And I just never believed it. I can remember being a small child and just being in church and thinking, how can this be right? So I was glad that I had that because I think a lot of my friends grew up with a lot of shame because of that. And I didn't internalize that at that time. I was just, I went, but I really didn't believe what they were saying.
Yeah, so did you, was religion a big part of your life then in the home?
Not so much in my home, but my grandparents were. They went to church, every time the doors were open. And I lived with them some when I was little. So they would take me to church with them. My family, my dad and my mom, my dad ended up leaving when I was four. And I lived with my grandparents some for a couple of years. And that was when I started to notice that I was different. I probably was 5 or 6 years old, and I was attracted to girls, and I wanted to marry a girl. And I always had a girlfriend. I thought that was different, and I never really said anything about it. But I guess because I felt so different because of my family, with a Yankee dad and an atheist father, and they already thought we were odd because my parents were divorced and nobody had ever been divorced there. So I just felt like that was just another part of being different from the kids that I grew up with there. And when I was little, I thought I was a boy. I wore boy clothes. I had a boy haircut. I played with boy stuff. If they gave me dolls, I would shave their hair off and make them into boy dolls. And wanted G.I. Joes and all that, but I never got any of those kind of things. The most I could ever get out of my mother was a little pack of green plastic army men at the grocery store. And I would get packs of those and play army. And it was weird because nobody in that town even acted like it was weird. They just thought that I was an ultra tomboy or something. And I never felt weird about how I was. I didn't feel like anybody thought much about it, which was nice. I grew up on the Tennessee River, and, during the day in the summer, I would get up and me and my dog would just go and we'd hit the woods and hit the boathouse and we'd be gone all day playing in the woods or whatever, I was always Daniel Boone or, you know, some male figure like Dr. Spock, or we'd play Star Trek, and I was always Dr. Spock. So it was really kind of a nice childhood living there in that town.
Yeah. So what, like, years were was would that be, like, approximately?
So I was about 9 when we moved from there, and we moved to a bigger city in Alabama, and I was behind academically because I'd gone from that small county school system to a city school system, so I had to struggle a little bit with that. And the very first day that I went to school, in the new school, the teacher put me in front of the class and was telling the students that they had a new student. And a boy in the back of the class yelled out, "Are you a boy? Are you a girl?" And I was,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it just stopped me. And I mean, it stopped me in my tracks. I mean, nobody had ever said anything like that to me, you know, ever. And of course, everybody in the class laughed. And so that was like a real turning point in my childhood. I went from a fairly happy, you know, a good student, and I was happy with how I was, and nobody said anything about it, to that. And it was a real shock for me. I was bullied. The kids bullied me. And so I didn't have any friends. And so I started to try to do things to fit in, you know, like I grew my hair out and I started to try to dress more like the girls in my class dressed. But I never fit in with them or with, you know, the guys. Like, I wanted to play boy sports and I wanted to do all that. And of course, you know, this was in 1969, in the late 60s. And so I was always put with the girls and I never, ever fit in with either group. So all through the rest of that grammar school and all through junior high and high school, I really had no friends. I was by myself a lot. And, you know, it was just a really lonely, really lonely time for me. My mother had always had gay friends when I was little and had gay friends when we moved. And I knew that I was different, but I didn't really identify with them either. Because I guess, and I've come to understand this more now, I didn't want a girl to like me because I was a girl. I wanted a girl to like me because I was a boy. And that was not possible. So I didn't really identify with the gay people I knew either. So high school was pretty rough. I graduated early because I just couldn't stand to go. I went as little as possible, and I petitioned the school board to let me graduate early. And they said, "Well, you'll miss the prom and you'll miss the senior picnic and all that." I said, "Do I look like I care about that? I don't care about that at all. I just want out of here." It was so bad. And I hung out with a guy that lived across the street. He was a misfit too. And we started smoking a lot of pot. And so that was kind of what got me through high school, was we would walk to school together and we'd smoke a joint on the way to school, which made it a little more tolerable. But I graduated early, and got a job. And then I went to college.
Yeah. So, during your childhood, like, what were your parents and grandparents like? Were they really open to people who didn't really identify with like the gender binary, you know, like men versus women.
Well, actually, I don't think that they had ever heard of anything like that. I mean, like when I was little, living in that small town, we lived on the river. And so our house was like a party house. And there were always people there on the pier drinking and, you know, spending the night and that kind of thing. And there were always women couples, lesbian couples, and there were always gay men couples. But the women couples were always, one woman was real kind of butch and the other one wasn't. And it was kind of like, you would say, well, who's the girl and who's the boy kind of thing. But there was no non-binary stuff. I mean, we'd never heard of that. And then the guys were mostly always kind of effeminate. Most of them were hairdressers, and I'm being real stereotypical, but that's how it was. The gay people that my mother knew later in the town where we moved, the bigger town, the guys were, some of them were very masculine and some were very feminine. So you were still into that, even though they were gay or lesbian, it was still relatively binary. I mean, people, like I said, they were either really butch or really effeminate. And you didn't see anybody that was kind of in between. I got really close to one of my mom's friends during that period of time when I was in high school. And his name was Fred Price, and my mother sort of disowned me when I was about 13 and told me that I was on my own. She didn't care what I did. She didn't care when I came home. She didn't care who I was with or whatever. So I smoked a lot of pot and stayed out of her way. And this one friend of hers, we just kind of hit it off, and he would come and get me before I could even drive and take me to his house, and I'd spend the weekend with him. Or if she kicked me out of the house or locked me out of the house, I'd call him and he'd come get me. And he was kind of like my savior in high school. He was just always there. And he really never dated anybody. He had some gender issues himself with his family. His dad was a preacher. Of course, my grandparents thought it was totally wrong that you would just go to hell if you were my grandmother called lesbians Lisbons. She said, if you're one of those Lisbons, you're going to hell. So we had some conversations about it. And I said, I'm sorry that you believe that way, but I don't believe that way. I don't think that I'm going to hell, and I really don't want to ever have this conversation again. So we never did. And she and my grandfather eventually, and actually pretty quickly, came to accept how I was, and they accepted if I was with someone and they came home with me for Christmas or something, if they got me a present, they got her the same present. And they called my partners my buddy. That, you know, if they called, they'd say, how's your buddy doing? But they were okay with it, and they never gave me any trouble about it after that. And I got ahead of myself there, but when I went to college, I started going to gay bars. It was in the mid-70s, and the gay bars were really big with the disco music, and they were just really fun places to be. And I had a roommate who was an art major, and she and her boyfriend went to the gay bars, and they asked me if I wanted to go. And I had never heard of anything like that before. I mean, I knew those gay people my mother knew, but they never went to a bar, and I didn't know how they got to be gay or how they met people or anything. So I said, I'd love to go. And so I started going to the gay bars, and I started meeting girls who liked me, because all through high school, I had crushes on straight girls, and they never paid me any attention at all. And I just followed him around like a little puppy dog, you know, wanting him to talk to me and notice me. And they never did because they were straight. So I started going to the gay bars and I started running into girls and the girls liked me. And I thought, well, maybe I am a lesbian. I mean, it made more sense to me than anything else I had seen. So I came out when I was 19 as lesbian. That was in 1978. And my first partner was quite a bit older than I was and did not get along with my mother at all. They hated one another. So that was a real, real bad period of time with my mother hassling me and calling me and starting fights and stuff. And then my partner would get on the phone and then they would get into a fight. And it was not good. It was not good for anybody. My partner had been a heroin addict in the 60s. So we, because there was so much turmoil with me and with, you know, my mother and all that. So we started doing a lot of drugs and a lot of pills. And of course, that escalated to I was shooting some drugs at the time. And I was in college, but I wasn't doing very good because I was doing so many drugs. And I overdosed a couple of times and ended up in a psych ward and quickly begged to be transferred to a drug rehab program because I didn't want to be in the psych ward. I thought a drug rehab would be better. So I went there and my partner and I split up. I went through rehab, got clean, got, you know, quit drugs, quit drinking, went back to school. I didn't have anywhere to live, so I lived in halfway houses for a while. Went back to school, and it was then that I, again, over and over, I would fall in love with a straight woman. You know, either like classmates who are straight, or women that I met through the program, through AA or NA. There was no Narcotics Anonymous back then. Addicts went to AA. So I went through a period of a couple of years where I was in so much pain over wanting to change my gender. I had heard about some, you know, famous people, and back then they called them transsexuals, and I had heard about those people, and I started figuring out that, you know, I wasn't drinking, I wasn't doing any drugs, and I was thinking more clearly, and I was coming to the realization that I was not a lesbian, that I was actually trans, and we didn't even have a word for that then. I guess you would say transsexual, but those are the people who had surgeries. And, but I knew that I was not lesbian. I knew that I wanted to change my gender. So it was about the same time. I journaled for 2 years and I was in a lot of pain over it. Like, you know, every night saying, why did I have to be born in this body? Why is it so hard? And I had at one point decided that I would just kill myself. And I usually talked to my grandparents on Sunday. And I think it was on a Thursday or something that I decided that I was just going to go and kill myself because I couldn't deal with it. And I was getting ready to leave my apartment and my grandmother called. She never called like on Thursday ever, never. And yeah, so it really saved my life. I you know, I thought, gosh, how can I do that? I mean, why did she call me right now? So I decided just to put it away for a little bit. And about the same time, I did meet a transsexual. He was a friend of a friend. I went to college with him when he was presented as female. And he had had top and bottom surgery in Philadelphia. And yeah, back, and this would have been, I met him in 1982. So he probably had his surgeries in the late 70s, early 80s in Philadelphia. So she said, why don't we go and meet, you know, you can meet him. And so we drove up. He was living in Rhode Island. We drove up and stayed the weekend with him. And what had happened to him was so horrible. They didn't take good care of him when he had his surgeries, and he had terrible scars. I mean, he wouldn't even take his shirt off. He wouldn't show us his chest. It was so scarred. And wow. Yeah, he was not happy. His family had disowned him and said, we never want to see you again. And so he was struggling a lot with all of that. And so when I came back from meeting him, I thought, I can't, there's just no way I can do this. So I just resigned myself to just going on with my life, you know. I finished school.
So where did you go to college?
I went to the University of Alabama in Birmingham.
Okay.
And so, and that was another interesting thing. When I got out of drug rehab, and we were going, the drug addicts had to go to AA, and the people in AA didn't like us because we were young and we were drug addicts, you know. And they were, most of them were older people, and they're really hardcore alcoholics, and they didn't want to hear about that, about this drug stuff. They never heard of Quaaludes and cocaine, and they just didn't want to hear about it. So we started a gay AA. We had never heard of NA, but we started a gay AA. And and sometimes there were only one or two people that would come. There was one guy that came every single time, every single time. And sometimes it would just be him sitting there. And sometimes I would go and it would just be me and him. And then sometimes there'd be a few people. And it was mostly guys, and I loved them. You know, they called me Baby Butch, and I hung out with them mostly. And because it was a safe, you know, it was safe. I mean, they were gay guys. They weren't interested. What would happen occasionally if I tried to hang out with a straight guy, you know, it would end up in a bad situation because they would, you know, they would think, well, I'm going to be the guy that's going to change your mind about, you know, wanting to date women or whatever. And it always ended up bad. So I hung out with all these gay guys in gay AA. And it was 1982. We were at a meeting and these two guys came from Houston. And, you know, you could go to a town and look up and see where a meeting was. So they looked up and found gay AA. So they came to the AA meeting and they sat there and they cried. And they said, our friends are dying. All our friends are dying with this virus. And all our friends in Houston are dying with it. And our friends in California are dying with it. And we don't know why. We don't know what it is. And it was AIDS. But we had never heard of AIDS before. We had never heard of HIV. We had never heard of it. And I mean, they literally begged the guys in this group to please either abstain from having sex for a while or use protection or whatever. And of course, the guys, you know, that I knew, back then, you know, the big thing to do is cruise the park and just have sex with anybody that you found. And they didn't believe these guys from Houston. And all of those guys are dead or have been dead for many, many years. They all died with with AIDS. And you know, we just didn't have any way to figure what they were saying. You know, we just didn't not believe them, but we didn't really believe them. And I just can remember the guys saying, "Oh, that's just bullshit. You know, I don't know. We don't know anything about that here." And as I said, they all of those guys that were friends of mine died with AIDS. I was working in an ICU at UAB at the time, and it was a burn unit, so we had private rooms, and usually ICUs don't have private rooms. And we got all the AIDS patients, and I took care of all those people.
So were you concerned at all then, for yourself, like with AIDS, you know, being such an emergent?
Yeah. If you can believe this, I drew lab work and drew blood and started IVs and drew blood gases and all kinds of things on those patients, with no gloves.
Wow.
Because we didn't know. And, back then, if you were a nurse, we were taught never to wear gloves because it made the patients feel weird, like we didn't want to touch them. So, I mean, you know, if we were cleaning, if somebody would use a bedpan or something, we would use gloves. But we didn't use gloves to start IVs or draw blood or any of that. So we took care of all those guys in the unit with no gloves and you know, minimal precautions. We really weren't that concerned about it. You know, we would just say, "I don't know what this is, really, so I'm not going to worry about it." And none of us that took care of those guys, as far as I know, ever got anything. But it was a weird time. My cousin died with AIDS also, and he would actually be at a doctor's office in a wheelchair when he was really bad. His mother would take him to the doctor, and he would need to use a bathroom, and they would say, "We don't have a bathroom." That's how bad.
Because he had.
Yeah, that's how bad it was. I mean, even the medical community, you know, didn't even want him to use their bathroom.
So like the fear of getting it.
Yeah, they were. Everybody was so. We weren't scared, but everybody else was really scared. And his mother took care of him until he died, and she didn't get anything either. So, but there was a lot of hysteria about it. And like I said, you know, all those people died that I knew. A whole generation of just wonderful guys, you know, smart, creative, just great guys and just wiped out. Go ahead.
So with AIDS, So with AIDS, a lot of people like had tied it right to the gay community and to like the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
So were you ever worried about that? Like about people tying you to that and maybe treating you with the same way as like you had mentioned with your cousin? Fear?
Yeah, there was a fear, and not so much with the lesbians in the community. I mean, at that time, lesbians kind of had this attitude of, "Well, it isn't happening to us," you know, that kind of thing. Unless you slept with guys also, or unless you slept with bisexual. So at that time, the lesbian community felt pretty, we felt like we were okay. Like we didn't think we were going to get it. As long as you didn't sleep with the guy or sleep with the guy who slept right. with guys or sleep with the woman who slept with guys. So there was a lot of, like who you sleeping, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know who's that, who does she sleep with? That kind of thing. Back then, I mean, women weren't using protection. We never heard of dental dams or, you know, any of that, but we did kind of be, we were really careful about women who might sleep with guys. So you didn't sleep with a woman who might have slept with guys because you didn't know. Yeah, so there was a, actually, that I say that, there was some paranoia that was going around about it. Like, you know, don't, you just stick with the people you know, don't sleep with somebody you don't know, which had not been the case in the 70s, in the early, you know, in the 70s, everybody slept with everybody. Nobody used protection. You know, the worst you could get was gonorrhea, and you could clear that up pretty easy. There was no herpes. There was no, you know, syphilis was very rare. I mean, there was nothing that people could get really that, so, you know, in the 70s, I mean, everybody was sleeping with everybody. So this kind of changed everything, you know, even for us too, it did. 'Cause there was paranoia about it. I left, Birmingham and, went to South Florida for about 5 years. My partner and I moved down there I went back and got another bachelor's. I didn't get a master's, but when I got out of there, we went to, and there was homophobia in that program, in the second program I went to. The director of the school said that he was going to rid that my whole profession of queers.
What was your profession?
I did anesthesia for 32 years. Nurse anesthetist. So he came to our school and he said he was going to rid the profession. There was a lot of, you know, there were quite a few gay men who were anesthetists, and there were quite a few lesbians who went to anesthesia school, and he made the comment he was going to rid the profession of all the queers. So my last year in that program was really not fun. He kind of had it out for me the whole time. I had a 4.0 GPA, graduated with honors, and he didn't give me any recognition for that.
Wow.
There was another gay guy in my class, and he and I kind of stuck together and kind of weathered the whole thing. And what was funny, he handpicked the next class, and there were two lesbians in the next class, and he didn't know it. Like he knew, like he thought he could tell who was lesbian and gay, and he didn't have a clue. But he was going to rid the profession of us. So thank God my friend was in the class, and we ended up sticking together, and we made it through the program with all that.
So were there any, any gays, like, or queer spaces, I guess, at either one of those programs you went to?
Yeah,
like places where you could find like a community?
No, there weren't at all. And the first, when I went to nursing school, there was none. There was, this is interesting though, the dean of the nursing school, when I had gotten in drug treatment, he was a gay guy. And he and I had kind of hit it off when I was there as a student. And I was on an ethics committee and all that, you know, before I got all drugged out. You know, I was trying to be good. But for some reason, he took a liking to me. And when I got out of drug treatment, you know, I had to reapply to get back in school. And a lot of the professors didn't want me there because of my drug, because of the drugs. And this, the dean said, look, I like you a lot. and I'm going to let you back in this program. But you better, by God, not make one bobble or your ass is out of here. And I said, okay, well, okay. So I got back in because of him. But yeah, there was no, I didn't know any gay people in that program. I knew him. And that was it. There were no gay spaces. There were no like gay bookstore. You know, there was just nowhere. The only place where anybody met anybody gay was at a bar. Yeah. So, you know, when I got out, of course, I didn't go to any bars anymore and didn't go anywhere. I met somebody who was actually a sister of one of my mother's friends when I was little, one of the gay women, one of the lesbian women. And we thought that was a sign we were supposed to be together. So we got together and we moved to South Florida. That was pretty non-eventful. I mean, we lived down there for 5 years and we should have never gotten together. That was not a sign. And my dysphoria, my discomfort with my body was getting worse. I didn't want anybody looking at me, you know, like I didn't want her looking at me. And I was just getting more and more uncomfortable with just my body. So we broke up and nothing really happened down there. We didn't really have any friends. Nobody really knew that we were, that we lived together. We just kind of moved in, and you know, everybody's transient in South Florida. So nobody cares what you are, what you're doing. You know, they don't even pay attention. So I left there and went to North Carolina and, was there for 8 years. Met somebody there, who kind of, you know, moved in, met me and like moved in. And we were together, till we moved here actually. And, North Carolina, the people there that I worked with knew that, you know, we were living together and all, but it was never talked about. And we weren't very active, because neither one of us drank, so we didn't go to bars, and we didn't really know how to meet other gay people. We knew a few people that we hung out with. And something happened there that had never happened before. We went to eat one day, and I had a rainbow flag on the front of the truck, and we came out, got in the truck, and we were driving home. It was in the summer. We had the windows rolled down. And all these people at the stoplights were yelling, "Dykes, faggots, dykes," and like screaming and waving their fists at us and stuff. And we were going, "What happened? That didn't happen when we drove over here. Like what happened between when we got to the restaurant and going home? Did all of a sudden..." Every red light, people were screaming at us. And it was really scary. I mean, really scary.
So what year was this?
This would have been in probably 1994.
Oh, okay.
And it was in Greensboro. So we get home and somebody had written all over the flag and all over the front of the truck, I'm a faggot, I'm a dyke, with lipstick. So we had driven all the way across town with this graffiti on the truck, and we didn't even know it was there. But the response was terrible. I mean, people like really screaming at us. And like I said, that had never happened before. I had never had anybody, you know, say anything untoward toward me, you know, at work or anywhere, even though they knew it was never talked about. But that was a really scary experience for me, that would happen, that people would feel, you know, so bold that they would scream and wave their fists at us and yell at us like that. So that was pretty different. And that would have been probably in 94. We kind of stayed to ourselves there. And then we decided to move to Virginia 21 years ago. And
Oh.
an employer that I'd worked for in North Carolina moved a little bit north of here and was working in a hospital north of here. And she asked me to come up and look around, and we did. And of course, it's beautiful up there.
Yeah.
And what was nice about it, before I even came to meet everybody, she told everybody that I was a lesbian, and everybody was fine with it. And we came up and interviewed and went to dinner, and everybody was perfectly okay with that, which had been different because it had always been under, it'd always been under wraps or kind of quiet. Nobody ever said anything about it, but
Oh.
everybody was, at work was okay. We moved up there, and we lived in a pretty, I would say it was kind of a famous house. Everybody up there knew the house, and everybody wanted to live there. And so I bought that house not knowing that, but that kind of made us a spectacle because everybody wanted to know who lived in that house. And so at work, things are fine, but everywhere we went, people would say, "Oh, you're those women that live in that house." And
Huh.
I had a crew cut and had a bunch of tattoos, and it was hot as hell, and we were always wearing like sleeveless shirts and stuff, and it didn't go over very well up there in the
Huh.
community. People made
Like in what
comments.
way?
We were just different. I mean, a woman with a crew cut and tattoos kind of stuck out up there, and especially two women living together. And we'd go vote, and people would say, "Oh, so y'all are those women that live in that house." And it a lot of
Huh.
homophobic comments at work, not directed at me, but about other people. And turned out not to be a very warm place to live or work. And I wasn't very happy with the job. My partner and I were not getting along very well.
Oh.
We pretty much, our relationship was pretty much non-existent. We just lived together, but we weren't very, getting well, we weren't really getting along. And it was when the shooting happened Backstreet here. So, we were living up there, and it was in September of 2000 when the shooting happened here. I'm sure you know about that, Backstreet. So we watched all that on the news, and we were very impressed with the response from the community and with the gay community here. And at that time, and of course I'm old, so for years and years it was just the gay and lesbian community. There wasn't a LGBTQ and all that. It was so if I say the gay and lesbian community, I'm not trying to exclude anybody, but that's what it was for us. And we were so impressed with how the gay and lesbian community handled the shooting and how Roanoke seemed to rally around the community. So we decided to move here. So we moved here in February of 2001, right, not too long after the shootings. And of course, MCC, the Metropolitan Community Church, was in the news a lot. And we had always been excluded from church. So we said, "Oh, we want to go there." So we started going to the church, got pretty involved in the church there. And because we lived out in the country and had, a big porch and all, we were kind of like the hanging out spot for some couples. People would come up here, I'd cook big meals, I would cut people's hair on the porch. I eventually ended up being called Daddy by some people. And let's check with daddy about that. And I guess I was emerging more as a male energy. So yeah, that relationship didn't last very long. She was very introverted and didn't work. And so when she left, I told her to keep going to MCC because we knew some people there, and she didn't know anybody because she didn't work and I worked. And I said, why don't you just continue to go to MCC and I will just not go there, so that you'll be more comfortable. And I just kind of hung out with the people I worked with. People knew about this and knew about us and knew that we broke up, and people at my job were very supportive during that time. And yeah, so she left.
So how did
Yeah.
Yeah, so about religion. So how did you, like, you had mentioned earlier that, like, in your childhood, you kind of felt sort of excluded or that you didn't really fit in with
Yeah,
religion. So how did that
I
change for you?
didn't. I didn't, and I left the church when I was really young. And then when my grandmother died, I was 39, and I was with the partner that we moved here with. And she had never gone to church ever. Her family never went to church. And my grandmother asked me when she was dying, she said, I really wish you would find a church. It was something that was real important to her. So I said, okay. So before we moved here, when we were living in North Carolina, there was a new church that opened up and it was right near our house. And so we said, okay, this is a sign. We're going to go to this church, and just see. So we went there and we talked to the minister and we told him that, that we were a lesbian couple, and he said, I don't care. And so we were going there for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, and my partner was baptized there. She had never been baptized. And we felt, we were kind of getting into the church thing a little bit. I would say that I was agnostic, not atheist, but more agnostic. And she was really glad with the whole thing and was baptized there. And probably a few months after that, the woman who was supposed to take care of the crib babies while they were in church was sick. And the preacher's wife came and asked me if I would take care of the crib babies that morning. I said, sure, why not? I'm a nurse, it would be perfect. So I took care of the babies. And on Wednesday, some people knocked on our door, and it was some of the deacons from that church. And they said that the church was upset that I took care of the crib babies and that they never wanted me near their children.
Oh, did they say why?
They didn't like our lifestyle and they didn't want us around any of the kids in the church. They said they had the kid zone. It was like a kid zone where all the nurseries were and the kid rooms and all that. And the deacon said, you can continue to come to the church, but you cannot be even in the kid zone area. Nobody wants you near their children. Yeah, so I was like, well, you know what I said. I don't know if I can say that here, but F you. And so we quit going. And but she kind of she missed that. And so, when we moved here and we learned about MCC and we'd seen the pastor on the news about the shootings and we'd seen the church, so we thought, well, okay, we'll try this. At least it's a church where we won't be asked to leave because they don't want us around their kids, So anyway, she ended up kind of hanging out at that church for a little bit. She became agoraphobic and pretty almost drank herself to death. After 9/11, she got really drunk and yeah, it was kind of sad. And I don't know if she's okay now, but anyway, so I just kind of, when all that happened, when we broke up and all, I just kind of went underground and stayed out here in the country by myself. I saw some people transitioning when we moved here, some younger people. And I just thought, I was 40 by then. And I thought, God, if I were 20, I would do it. But I was already working here, already had a career. And I really thought that they would fire me, you know, if I said that I wanted to transition. I didn't know anybody personally who transitioned, but I had seen, you know, some people around town where people would say, oh, look, they're transitioning. But I didn't know how they did it or what they did. I just knew that I saw them several months later and they looked more like a guy. And I thought, God, I wish I just want to do that. But I was 40 and I thought I was too old. And I was afraid that my job would fire me. So for 20 years, I sat here and I worked and I took care of my animals and I really saw nobody. And I wanted to transition more and more. And in 2019, when I was 60, I could retire from work. And so I knew that nobody could hurt me anymore. You know, like they couldn't fire me. They couldn't take away my income because I was eligible for a pension. And so I went to, I told a good friend of mine that I'd known for 40 years that I wanted to transition. And she said, I think that's the smartest thing you've ever said in your life, which was all I needed. I just needed one person to say, one person to say, yeah. So I went to my boss and I said, I'm going to retire. And she asked me why. And she said, you're too young and you're really good at your job and we really don't want you to retire. What's going on? And I said, I've wanted to transition for 40 years and I've been too afraid. And now I can retire and I'm going to retire so that I can transition. And, and she said, oh, no, you're not. You're not going to retire. You're going to stay here and you're going to do this here. And we're going to get you through this and we're going to do every, I'll do everything in my power to make this easy for you. And she said, I'm just sorry you waited 60 years to do this.
Wow. So was everyone as supportive as her?
Yes. Yes. It was the most amazing thing I've ever witnessed. To go from being a recluse for 20 years who really had nothing to do with people, didn't really care for people very much. I worked at night, so I didn't have to be around people very much. Everybody, I went to my director and told her, and she said, it's fine. How do you want to deal with this? Do you want to send a blast email out? Because I worked with several hundred people. Do you want me to blast an email out and tell everybody that your new name is Price and that you are transitioning or what? And I said, no, actually, I would rather talk to everybody in person. And so I did for a year. I worked there. We figured out that, you know, I had to change clothes at work. So I didn't want, to change clothes with all the women I worked with for all the long, even though they didn't care. They're like, we don't care if you change clothes with us. We don't give a shit. You know, we don't care, but I couldn't go in the men's dressing room and change clothes with all the guys I'd worked with for 20 years. I mean, I felt like that would be too weird. So they worked it out that I could change clothes in my boss's office. And I had a little locker in there that I kept my stuff in. And for a year, I spoke to everybody in person. As I worked with people, you know, as I worked with surgeons or worked with anesthesiologists or nurses, or I worked in endo and I worked in radiology and the cardiac cath lab, all the places that I worked, when I would work there, I would just say, I need to talk to you for a minute. And I would tell them that I'd changed my name to Price and that I was transitioning female to male. And I was astounded. People told me stories they would have never told me about their own kids, about their uncle, about their cousin, about, it was amazing. It was just, it was really an amazing experience. They were, before I changed my name legally, they were already putting Price on my card at night when I came into work. They were so excited. Oh. And the reason they were so excited and the reason why they were so accepting, I had gone from this profoundly sad person to like the happiest person ever. I mean, I just... People would see me down the hall and come down and say, I can see the difference in you from way down the hall. You are just like a different person. Oh. And people would say, how can I not be happy for you when you are so happy? They went overboard to even some of the really religious people that I was worried about telling were amazing. Yeah. Nobody judged me. Some people didn't talk about it very much. Some people would ask me, you know, felt comfortable asking me questions or whatever. And I said, look, ask me anything you want to ask me. I'm an easy trans person. You've known me for 20 years. If you want to ask me a question, ask me. I'm the person to ask. And they'd say, gosh, we've never known a transgender person before. And I would have people come up and say, do you mind if I ask you something? And it was really, it was amazing. I quickly had top surgery, and a lot of my dysphoria with my body just was totally gone. I walked straighter, stood up taller, had a lot more confidence, even though, you know, there was a period of time, and still I get misgendered, but there was a period of time where I don't, you know, people didn't know if I was a girl or a boy or a woman or a man or whatever. But even in that weird period of time when people treated me so well, and were so respectful, and mostly they just did not want to make a mistake and say something that would hurt my feelings or that would, you know, they'd say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that like that. And I said, you work with me for 20 years. It's hard to go from, you know, change over like a light switch. I get that. So yeah, it was really an amazing time. And just as a side note, I chose Price as my name because of my friend Fred Price, who saved my life so many times in high school. He committed suicide when I was 20. And so I carry him with me, and I sound like it's emotional. I'm really proud to carry his, to have his name. So anyway, that's, so now, I'm getting more involved. I don't have all the dysphoria that I have. I'm not so anxious socially. I could never go anywhere socially before. And now I don't have that anxiety like I did. So I'm on the board of Sarah here in town, the sexual assault, hotline. They also do counseling. I'm also a crisis counselor for them, and a crisis advocate, not a counselor. I'm an advocate. I answer the phone. And then when we get to where we can go to the hospital with assault victims or whatever, we'll be going back like to the hospital, the police station, with victims. And they wanted someone on the board who was transgender, because we know, trans people are assaulted on a regular basis, but they don't call the crisis line. So we're trying to figure out why that is, and also give trans people or people in the LGBTQ community a safer space to report assault. I'm also trying to do some stuff with the Diversity Center now. I've met some folks down there. So I'm hoping
the
to
Diversity
get,
Center?
Yeah, downtown. I'm hoping to get involved.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's not open. Well, it's open some now, but I'm hoping to get more involved with that. I did end up retiring because of COVID. After a year. I was going to go to trade school in the spring, but that didn't happen yet. So, because COVID's still bad. Huh. But I retired because of COVID, because everybody I cared for was presumed positive. And with my age, I just said, I'm done. But no, it's coming out and just saying I'm transgender was like the most freeing thing that I've ever done. I wish I had done it 40 years ago. I wish I had not been such a coward.
Huh.
But I've never been happier. And I'm trying to find ways to give back to the community now that I kind of had deserted, you know, for most of my life, and not participated in. But I was amazed at the response I got when I came out. Most people said, yeah, we knew it all along, or yeah, we saw it all along, or whatever. But it's not something that somebody comes to you and says, like, hey, I think you ought to be a guy. I think you'd be a better guy. You know, my friend of 40 years now, she'll say things like, you really are a guy. You know, or I felt like you dismissed me the other day or something. I'm like, I didn't do that. It's been very interesting. And it's such a, I think it's such an asset to have been socialized for so long as a woman. And, you know, knowing what women's issues are intimately and now getting to be, you know, on the other side, sort of. That's been
so how about like community now? You had mentioned trying to be like more involved. Like, have you found any, you know, like LGBTQ spaces?
I have met I've met some trans men who have like taken me under their wing. They transitioned many years ago, most of them, but they said, you know, you kind of can be an honorary member because of your age. You're 62. You've been around for a long time, and you've lived in isolation for so long. And we don't think it's right that you don't have a community of guy friends to hang out with. So they've kind of taken me under their wing. I hope that I can go. They're going on a camping trip in June. I hope that I can go on the camping trip with them, because I missed all the socialization as a guy. You know, I didn't have guy friends to hang out with. I didn't have guy friends to do things with. It's kind of hard when you're 62 to make guy friends. But these guys have been amazing. They said, you know, we just want you to be part of our group. You deserve that. And I've also met, I've met a couple of gay guys that I've had like outside lunches with and stuff like that I never would have done before. And they're trying to give me tips on, you know, how to do my hair more like a guy and that kind of thing. I'm just learning all this stuff, you know. I mean, I got the clothes down because I always wore men clothes. But I had lunch with a gay friend the other day, and he said, dude, you got to do something about your hair. It's just borderline girly. So I came home and buzzed it and did it, you know, like he said, and I feel better. And for the last few days when I've gone places, I was called sir, which is always a big deal for a trans person. You know, you always want to be, it feels bad to be misgendered, even if you don't look so much like a guy, but still when someone calls you sir, it's very validating. So yeah, I've done that. I went to the Diversity Center and met some folks down there that I'm going to try to do some things with. And no, I feel like my life has made, my life is full. My life used to be, I used to say all the time, I don't feel connected to my life. I don't feel connected to my body. I don't feel invested in my life. I mean, I did my life. I worked. I paid the bills. I took care of things. But I have no joy. Like, I couldn't even understand why people would get so excited about going on a vacation. You know how people, we're going on a vacation in a week. And I think, so? Or, you know, putting up Christmas decor, any just normal things that people would do that they get excited about. I didn't have any of that joy. Like, I would be, I just was kind of drab and dead on just existing. And because I wasn't connected to my life, you know? There was nothing about my life that validated who I was. I was always hidden and invisible, and don't look at me and don't hear me. I didn't take up any space in the world. I was just here. And it's really interesting at 62 to be all of a sudden realizing that I do have a space in this world. And that there is a lot of joy. Yeah.
So how about actual spaces? Like, have you begun visiting, you know, like LGBTQ, like, you know, gay bars or
no,
anything like that?
No. Real space? Yeah, no, I haven't, but I do hope to get involved more, like I said, with the Diversity Center and meet some more people in the community. And, you know, learn about things that need to be done as far as, of course, you know, right now, thank God we have Biden in office, but all the backlash is really, really scary. I mean, even for me, like, am I going to be able to get health care? You know, am I going to be able to get hormones? Am I going to be able to, you know, those kinds of things? But to think that my younger, I mean, I have a young trans man friend who's 17. You know, like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to him? I have another friend who's 24. What's going to happen to him? You know, like, all the legislation that's been brought up just by Biden's election is it really sends people scurrying and afraid. My primary care physician I had for 12 years when I came out said, I don't want to see you anymore.
Wow. Why?
So I've had to scramble around for healthcare myself, and being a mid-level healthcare provider that was well respected as a 60-year-old woman, all of a sudden I'm a 60-year-old trans man, and it's been hard. It's been very difficult. So there are a lot of issues facing, you know, not just the trans community, but the LGBTQ everybody community. My non-binary friends, I'm more and more aware of their issues, what kind of issues they have socially, medically. So there are a lot of things that are now coming to the forefront that that I feel like I can find my niche and try to figure out what it is I can do to help my community. I always speak up. I've had things happen to me that I couldn't let go, you know, that I would have to call and say, look, I'm saying this because I'm transgender and what you've done here is transphobic. And I can let that go sort of on my own, but I'm not going to let it go because I can't let it go for my trans friends who are coming after me.
So what kind of experiences have you had?
So like when I rolled my money out of Carillion when I retired, out of the retirement fund into a private financial place, and I'm not really financial oriented, but I moved all the money out of Carillion into another private thing, and I gave them this pretty nice check. And they had only ever known me as Price. They had my driver's license, my social security card, my taxes were filed in my new name. Everything they had ever seen had my new name on it. And they called me and said they couldn't deposit the check. And I said, "Why can't you deposit the check?" And they said, "Well, we need documentation. We need the court order showing that your name had been changed." And I said, "I don't think so. I don't think so." I said, "You have every piece of ID that you have, bank accounts, everything, social, all that has my name on it. There's no reason for you to have to see a court order saying that my name was changed. And I think that you're being transphobic. I think you're asking me to go beyond what you would ask somebody else who changed their name because of marriage or whatever." And I said, "I'm not going to give you that document because I've already been vetted by the DMV. I've been vetted by Social Security. I've been vetted by all these other places, and I don't need to give you that information." And I said, "I'll just come and pick up my check." And she said, "Okay." And about 10 minutes, the guy that was in charge of my money called me, and he said, "Price, we don't need that piece of paper." And I said, "I didn't think you did." And so those kinds of things. I made an appointment with a doctor, and my name had changed, and they wanted my proof of my name change. I said, "I don't need to give you that. My insurance card has my new name. My driver's license has a new name on it. You don't need to see that." And so, you know what they did, being I guess one of those microaggressions that people do, they sent me a prescription to my dead name. And so I called him and I said, "How do you suppose I should get this prescription filled? You
Oh,
sent
right.
yeah You sent it to my dead name. I have nothing that has my dead name on it. Nothing. Everything I have has my new name on it. So how would you think I could get this prescription filled with that on there?" And I said, "You're very what you're doing is not okay. You've asked for court documentation of a name change. You don't need that. My insurance card says, the same thing, blah 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 blah." I said, "You don't need it." And she said, "Yes, sir, you're right. We don't need it. And where can I send the prescription to that you can pick it up?" She fixed it real quick. But so it's those kinds of things. It's just things that people think they can get away with until you call them on it. And I'm not a confrontational person, but in every instance like that, I feel like I have to step up and say, "No, this isn't right. It's not right for me, and it's not right for my 24-year-old friend that you might meet later. It's not okay. What you're doing is not okay. I don't know if you're doing it because you're curious or because you don't like the fact that I'm trans or why you're doing it, but you're not going to get away with it." So, I feel like I have to be on guard a lot of the time, anytime you're dealing with another agency or another office or, because it's invariably something's going to come up until maybe one day, 5 years down the road when my dead name doesn't show up on something. Like I went to get an X-ray and it was an ancillary. My chart at Carillion says Price Brown and it has my male gender marker on there. But I went to get an X-ray and it showed up my dead name with a female marker. And the girl handled it well. She goes, "Mr. Brown, could I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." She goes, "Did you change your name recently?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, I'm really I apologize, but it hasn't been changed on all the ancillary offices. But she was really nice about it, you know, and didn't make a big deal about it. And just, you know, she figured out what was going on and she wasn't going to make a spectacle of me. So I can handle that. But people are learning. I usually never get angry. I might get a little forceful sometimes, like, no, you don't need that. But yeah, I feel like you have to constantly kind of be on guard for that kind of thing. So,
yeah,
it's okay. Yep. It's so okay. It's worth it. Yeah.
Right. So kind of related to that, what you were talking about, of, you know, healthcare and that sort of thing. How's it been for you, like trying, like aging as someone who's newly trans, and how do you see that, you know, like, cause you used to be in the medical field. So how do you see like that process of aging as LGBTQ?
Yeah. It was really sad when I first started transitioning. I would look in the mirror and all I could see was an old man. And I just felt like, why did you wait until you saw this old man looking back at you? There have been some health issues. For one thing, I've been bounced around quite a lot in the last year. I've gone from doctor to doctor because they've either been disrespectful or did things that were not okay or said some terrible things to me. Finally, I found some decent doctors. But as far as my transition, and we've just kind of confirmed this with this new doctor I went to last week, who was absolutely wonderful, and apologized for all the other horrible things people have done and said to me. But but he just said, you know, you're asking a 62-year-old body a lot to go through another puberty, which is pretty much what happens when you transition. You know, I started taking testosterone about a year and a half ago, and it's like going through puberty when you're 12 years old again. You know, I had the acne. I had a bunch of acne to deal with. That was just crazy. Huh. I'm 61 years old and I'm dealing with acne. I'm asking my young friends, like, how do you get rid of this shit? You know, you know, your voice changing, your voice is, changing and cracking and, you know, doing all that. So that's really different, but it's also what I wanted all my life. You know, like I wanted to look more like I look right now. However, as an older person, we were talking about it just this week. My transition is slower than like my young friends. Like, they've seen a lot of changes more quickly than I have. You know, they have more of a beard. They have more body hair. You know, their leg. Now, I have on shorts or something. I still look like I'm a girl shaving my legs. You know, I don't have a lot of hair on my legs. So my transition is slower. And, you know, he informed me this week that, you know, I may not ever, it may take a really long time for me to reach to where my body looks exactly like I picture it would look in my mind, because it is going to be slower. You know, my body just doesn't change as quickly as a young guy. Right. So I've been dealing with that. And that's really okay. I mean, that was kind of to be expected, I think, that I wasn't going to just, you know, overnight become some Hulk or something. You know, like, I'm never going to be like this buff guy. You know, I think in my mind when I first started, I thought, oh, I'll get all buff and I'll, you know, I'll look. Well, that's not going to happen. You know, I'm 62 years old, but I look around at other cisgender 62-year-old men and I think, well, I don't look any worse than most of them, you know? And that's kind of mean to say, but it's some consolation. Like, I'm okay. I'm not ashamed of my body anymore. I'm not ashamed to go in public. I'm not, ashamed to walk into a place and be automatically lumped with, you know, the women. God didn't know what to say to the women. You know, I live like no one's ever been to my house that I work with ever, because I have camping chairs in my living room. That's my furniture. And I'm perfectly fine with it. I don't care that there's camping chairs in my living room. But, you know, most 62-year-old women I know don't have camping chairs in their living room for their furniture. So, and camping stools and stuff. But it works for me, and that's fine. So I don't have to hide anymore. I don't have to, you know, now if somebody came to my house, they'd just go, oh, okay, you got camping chairs. Cool. But, you know, a couple of years ago, somebody came to my house and they think, why is a 62-year-old woman got camping chairs in her house? So it's just made all the difference in the world to me. And I'm so happy for my younger trans men, friends who are able to go ahead and do this when they're younger and their bodies will change and look like they want to look, and they can have, if they want to have more surgeries, they can do that. They can be socialized as guys. I mean, I see these 20-year-old guys I know, and they're out running around with 20-year-old guys doing guy things and having fun. And I never got any of that, you know? So there's a lot of grief that goes with, you know, the would have, had have, should have, could have, what my life could have been. You know, I wanted a wife and kids in a regular life. And, you know, but I didn't want to have kids. I wanted a wife that would have kids and, growing older with my colleagues, you know, their kids are going to college and graduating college and they're getting married and they're having grandkids. And there's some grief in that, you know, like I wish I had had that. But I can't dwell on that, you know, I have to, do what I can and, to be happy and to help other people and to, you know, hopefully maybe someone will hear my story and it'll resonate with them and maybe they won't wait so long.
Yeah. So do you have any other friends who are like older and trans or, you know, members of the LGBTQ?
So I had, when I first came out, I kind of tried to break into a trans group here. And it's mostly, or this is my feeling, and I was probably being oversensitive. I felt like it was mostly dominated by some trans women. And of course, it was a virtual space because it was COVID and nobody, I haven't met these people face to face. But I felt like there was a lot of, I didn't feel very welcome, to be honest. And I don't know if that was, I was trying to, you know, become an activist, but really didn't know what to do. I didn't feel like you walk on to something. Okay, I'm a walk on. I'm 60 something years old. I haven't been trans. I haven't dealt with these issues my whole life because I've always presented as a woman and I was always respected as a mid-level provider and I didn't have any problems really in my life. So I didn't want to be a walk on advocate and act like, okay, here I am now and I know everything and let's fix it. That's not the way to do it. But I never had that attitude about it. But I felt like when I would offer information in these spaces, that I would constantly be challenged by these people. Like, for prove it, you know, prove what you're saying. Tell us, who did you talk to? We want to know. We want to ask them. You know, I'm thinking I'm 60 years old. I'm a professional. I'm not going to lie about stuff. I mean, I'm just trying to pass on information that I thought might be helpful to people. And so I kind of got my feelings hurt a little bit. And I don't know if they, I didn't ever mean to go into that space with an attitude like I knew everything, because I don't. I don't, and it's hard to tell when you're just typing and you're not seeing somebody face to face and you're not talking to them, you know, how, what their intentions are, if they really are like trying to be a know-it-all and tell you what to do, or, but that wasn't how, what, that's not how it was offered. But I felt, I didn't feel very welcome. So I just kind of backed out of that.
Yeah. Do you think it was because of your age or just the group?
I don't know. I've heard from other people that the trans community here is kind of clicky, a little bit clicky. And being never having been a joiner, like I never joined stuff because I was such a loner. It wasn't that important to me to join that community. So when I got kind of shot down a couple of times with things that I would offer as information in that way, I just kind of said, F that, you know. I'll just figure it out on my own or whatever. But now that I'm more comfortable with myself, and with COVID, hopefully I got vaccinated this week, I got my first vaccine. Hopefully I'll be able to move into some more, some spaces that are not virtual, where I can actually meet some people and so that they can see that my intention is, you know, not to take over anything, but I do feel like I have a place and an obligation to speak up for my community.
So just kind of, you know, like thinking about your life overall and how it is different, you know, now, what do you think like about the new, you know, developments, you know, this increased visibility, I guess, of the LGBTQ community and like the new acronym and the internet as a space, you know, for them to connect. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's amazing. Like I said, I think I've learned most, you know, when I even came out, there was no internet, there was no nothing. When I came out lesbian in the 70s, there was, I don't even know when I got internet. I think it was close to 2000, 20 years ago. And it was awful. It was Prodigy and it was dial up. It was awful. But no, I think it's amazing that people can find themselves on the internet now. You know, you can find people who look like you and who have your story, and you don't have to spend, you know, 20 years fumbling around out there trying to figure it out on your own and figure out what's wrong with me? Like, why am I like this? Like I said, there was no word transgender. There was no nothing. I mean, I just thought I was a boy until people pointed out the fact that I wasn't. You know, and then I went, oh, okay, well, I guess I have to act like I'm supposed to then, which, you know, was horrible. But yeah, the whole visibility thing, I just feel like, you know, the suicide rate in the trans community is higher than anything. If we can just save one more person, and not lose another person because of ignorance or whatever. And like I said, I never knew any non-binary people, and now I know, I'm kind of close to several non-binary people, and I learn something from them every day, about what they have to deal with. And what they deal with is sometimes a lot worse than what I deal with. So, you know, I need to support those people and speak up for those those people too, those friends of mine. They're awesome people. And I think it's, I just think it's great that people have the ability to be who they are, you know, to express themselves however they want. I mean, more and more people are talking about the difference between, you know, nobody knew the difference between gender identity and sexual orientation and gender expression. Nobody ever heard of all that before. And now people are talking about it. And that it doesn't all add, you know, it doesn't have to be one way or the other. And I think for me, one of the biggest things is whatever parts you have doesn't really matter. it just doesn't really matter. Your gender's in your head. That's been a real, it's opened up a lot of things for me. I had someone ask me on my non-binary friend's site, we were talking about something, and a woman asked me, what parts do you have? And I'm thinking, how am I going to answer that? Took me a while to come up with an answer for it, but it's, you know, without just being mean to her, but people are really hung up on that. Like the whole bathroom issue, the whole women's trans sports issue, they're hung up on what body parts you have. And that has nothing to do with anything. So, So I'm really happy about, I'm happy that I jumped in when I did. A lot of really brave people came before me, and I'm always grateful for them, that they had the courage to do this when I was too scared. I was too afraid. I owe a lot to the people who came before me. I have a lot of gratitude for those people. So I hope that I can be that for somebody else, you know, and also be somebody that someone older who's thinking about transitioning, that has wanted to transition and thinks they're too old. You're not too old. It's doable. It may not be as quick as it would have been, but it's doable. And the change in my life has been, you know, I'm a whole person now, and I was never a whole person. It's been an awesome journey.
Sounds like it.
It has been.
Well, that's all the questions, you know, I had, but unless there's something else that, you know, you wanted to share that.
No, I feel like I talked your ear off. I'm sorry if I talked your ear off. I didn't mean to.
No, but
I've enjoyed doing it. And thank you very much for spending time with me today. I know you have another class. I hope I didn't run you over.
No, you're good.
Okay.
Yeah, you're fine.
All right.
Yeah, thanks so much for talking with us, too. I'm sure that people are going to really enjoy, you know, listening to your story and learning about, you know, how, because I think it's pretty rare, you know, to transition as like an older person. So.
Yeah, I know there's a couple of people in town who transitioned a little later, and I meet people online in groups a lot who are in their 40s and they're thinking they're too old, and I'm always first to say, no, you're not, you're not too old. If it's going to make you happy, it's going to make your life better, your life fuller. I mean, the way I relate to people is so different now. There's no way to describe it. If I can, you know, if somebody hears this and is inspired to go ahead and do it, you know, that's what I'm about. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Stephanie.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. I hope you have a good afternoon. Thanks a lot.
You as well.
Okay. Bye.